And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. The Latin writer Publius Syrus, who was a contemporary of Julius Caesar, once wrote, "Debt is the slavery of the free." America's 31st president, Herbert Hoover, said, "Blessed are the young, for they shall inherit the national debt." Hoover, by the way, was president at the time of the famous Wall Street crash of 1929. And Lord Byron, who died 200 years ago last week and lived for a while here in Geneva, wrote, "It is very iniquitous to make me pay debts. You have no idea of the pain it gives one." As ubiquitous as it is and unloved as it may sound, debt is my topic today. It is one of those conditions of living, of life, for many of us. And because so many economies, whether national or personal, are delicately balanced these days, I thought I'd devote a program to it in an effort to understand what is going on today and why debt, especially the debt of governments, features quite prominently in the daily news. Now, to help me understand better is a friend and neighbour, we live quite close to each other, who has devoted his entire professional life to managing other people's money. Recently retired, he regularly comments with knowledge, clarity and good humour on financial markets and related topics. And I've turned to him today to listen and learn. Clive Thompson is my guest, now retired. His professional career in banking dates back almost 50 years and included prominent names like Lloyds Bank, Bank of Nova Scotia Trust in the Cayman Islands, and that's a lovely spot to be. And then in Switzerland with Kleinwort Benson, Barclays, Coutts, where we first met each other, and then Union Bancaire Privée, where he was a member of the senior management. You can hear from those names that we're in the company today of someone who knows what he's talking about. Welcome to the McKay Interview, Clive, and thank you for inviting me to your home for this radio conversation and for making time for me.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for choosing to interview me. I hope I can provide your listeners with some clarity on where the world is going in terms of what they're reading about in the newspapers, which basically is we've got too much government debt at the moment and it's getting worse.
I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will, Clive. Well, you mentioned the word debt. I've mentioned it two or three times already. Is government debt really a problem? And if it is, why?
So let's go back to the Maastricht Treaty in 1992 when the EU was being formed. And they decided at the time that no government which was going to join the EU or the European Monetary System should have a debt level greater than 60%. Now, back then, the average of the EU was 40%, so 60% was a level which was relatively high, they thought, but still bearable. And anything above that, they thought that the economy wouldn't be able to sustain a debt level above 60%.
And in the treaty, governments signed up to it?
All governments signed up to it. All European governments signed up to it. Now, if we go back to the levels of debt in 92, as I said, the average was around 40%. In fact, the UK had a very low level of debt, which was 21.6%, so it was below the average. But where are we today? Well, the average in the EU is way beyond the 60% limit that they set themselves. Currently, the average of the euro area is 89.9%, so going on 90%. So it's 50% higher than they thought was sustainable. And the UK is currently around 100% debt to GDP. When I refer to debt to GDP, that's the total amount of debt divided by the GDP.
The gross domestic product.
That's right, yeah. The gross domestic product. Yeah. So if the GDP grows, of course, your absolute debt number can grow, but it's a problem if the debt is growing faster than GDP, and that is what has been happening over the last 50 odd years since the EU came into existence.
And why is that a problem?
So it's a problem because you get to a point where the spending starts to spiral out of control, and it's exacerbated by the interest which has to be paid on the debt. Now, you can imagine, if I know this is not an individual, but if you had an individual with a credit card, and they keep increasing their credit card debt, at some point, the level of debt will be so high that the interest is unmanageable by that person. And this is what's going on in the whole Western world. The interest rates are, because of the higher and higher debt as a percentage of GDP, the interest rates are getting higher as a percentage of the tax take. And that basically leaves less money for the government to spend on other things, or the governments do what they're doing at the moment, which is fill the gap by borrowing more and more, so the debt is starting to increase at a faster pace than it has been historically, so that they can pay the interest and so they can keep spending at the old rate.
So we're going to come to more into the interest issue a little bit later, but at this point, let's bring into the discussion the United States of America, because its national debt seems, to my uneducated eye, to feature prominently in a lot of the news analyses these days. What is it, Clive, about the United States? Is this really the problem, the USA? And if it is, in which direction is that problem heading in America?
So the biggest problem we do have is the US debt.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that the US dollar is, broadly speaking, the currency used by the world. Now, if we go back in time, the dollar was gold, or rather, the dollar was represented by gold. So the gold was the currency. And in 1934, they effectively abandoned the gold standard internally within the United States, but not for overseas nations. And in 1944, whilst remaining on the gold standard officially, as far as the dollar was concerned, for foreign nations, they persuaded under the Bretton Woods Conference that all nations should use the dollar as the method of international settlement, and only in as a last resort should gold be used to settle international debts.
And of course, at that time, America was top nation.
Yeah. So having persuaded the world to take dollars for everything, it allowed the United States to go on a bit of a spending spree, which they did, and so the net result of that was all around the world, everyone had dollars, and the United States had a very large debt. So along come a number of nations and ask for their money back, i.e. they'd like to change their dollars into gold. France was one of those nations. So they arranged with the United States to send in their dollars electronically, and they sent a battleship off to New York to pick up the gold.
Seriously, they sent a battleship.
You need to be, if you're transporting a lot of gold, you need to make sure it's safe.
I thought that was the stuff of romantic novels.
Well,
that's really true.
Yeah, look out for pirates.
Okay.
But anyway, long and short it was, before they got there, they were very politely told, "We're very sorry, but you can't have your gold, because if we give you your gold, it would be unfair to everyone else."
Right.
"Because we don't have enough." Okay. To give everybody their fair share.
1944, we're talking.
No, we're in 1971.
1971, sorry.
This was what's called the Nixon gold shock.
Ah, yeah.
So President Nixon temporarily suspended the convertibility of the dollar into gold at that moment, which meant the French could get dollars for their dollars, but they couldn't get gold for their dollars. And having suspended the convertibility of the dollar to gold, it meant that any sort of restraint on government borrowing had gone. Now, that meant that the US government's debt increased gradually over the years, but along comes the 2008 debt subprime mortgage crisis, and the government has to go on a spending spree to bail out the banks and bail out all and sundry. And they found that they could do this with almost impunity, because it had very little effect on inflation. Yes, inflation was still there, but it was modest compared with the amount of printing that was going on.
So they were printing money, essentially, without actually having an effect out in the so-called marketplace.
Yes, they were printing money and increasing the debt at the same time.
Yes.
And so as the government prints debt, the Federal Reserve would be buying some of that debt, and that's when the Federal Reserve buys debt, it has to print the money to buy the debt. That's how it works.
It sounds immoral.
Well, it's how it works. Obviously, if the public buys the debt, that's fine, but the public will only buy so much debt. So the Federal Reserve, at a certain point, was stepping in to buy debt. And that's why we hear about the central bank's balance sheets having expanded, and now they're trying to contract them. So the government kind of had learned a lesson. We can print with impunity, or borrow with impunity. And then we had the COVID crisis in 2021. And once again, there was a spending spree of borrowing more and more money. And the government debt has risen dramatically. So in the United States, the debt to GDP ratio is roughly around 100% at the moment. That's way more than the 40% that many economists thought that nations should have. 40% was really for developing nations. Economists used to say that for a developed nation, 60% would be fine. I couldn't trace it anymore, but there was one economist who used to say that 70% would be fine for a nation. Well, the United States is at 100%. Now, the problem here is not where they've got to, but it's where they're going. For the first time in history, the government's plan is to continue to increase that debt to GDP ratio on and on and on ad infinitum.
And you're talking the United States government?
Yes. You know. We're not just talking about increasing the level of debt. That's a given anyway in any scenario. We're talking about increasing the level of debt faster than the growth in GDP. And we can see those numbers on the government's own website. It's on the Congressional Budget Office's website. The website is cbo.gov. And you can see their budgets that they've always published. So they've got the budgets past, present, and projection for the future, including some long-term budgets. So the debt to GDP, which is around 100% this year, is forecast to go to about 102% next year. And the year after, it will go higher and higher and higher. So the forecast is for the level of government debt to keep rising. So by the end of this decade, according to their official forecast, it'll be 130% of GDP.
And two quick questions. One, first, these are decisions essentially that are political, not financial, than the movement. And the second one is, what does that debt comprise? I've read somewhere that it's essentially defense in the United States, Social Security, Obamacare. There are sort of three big chunks and pensions in the trillions. How is that debt then? So what about the interest? Someone has to pay the interest.
So basically, the debt is, the figure I'm talking about is the debt which has been issued to the public.
Right.
The public is you and me, your pension fund, foreign governments, people in Africa, anybody who has a dollar balance anywhere, which is, so they own US Treasury notes or US Treasury bonds or US Treasury bills. So bills are instruments up to 1 year, notes are 2 years and beyond, and bonds are 10 years and beyond. So those three things, Treasury bills, Treasury notes, and Treasury bonds, are what comprises the government debt. And it owes that debt to the public at large, who, when those bonds, notes, or bills mature, they will be presented back to the Treasury for repayment, and the government will borrow some more money to repay the old bill.
Pay them.
But of course, they also have to pay the interest.
Yes.
And since you asked about interest, that's where we're getting into a deeper problem in the United States, because not only is the level of government debt increasing faster than the gross domestic product, but the interest rate that they're having to pay is increasing rapidly as well. There's two reasons for that. One is because the absolute level of debt is getting bigger, and the other one is because interest rates, which have been close to zero over the last decade, are now rising rapidly. So to illustrate that, most of the amount of money that the government borrowed over the last decade was borrowed at rates of 2-2.5%. The money the government has to borrow now is at current rates. So if they're borrowing short-term through the Treasury bill market, and they're doing a lot of that, it's costing them 5.4%.
So more than double.
Which is the going rate on the bill market. And if they're borrowing on the, let's say, the 10-year bond, that's about 4.6%, 4.7%, and that's an interest rate which seems to be rising at the moment. So as debt matures, that is the money they borrowed 5 years ago with, let's say, a 5 or 10-year maturity, as it matures, they have to renew that debt, but at a higher rate. So a minute ago, I told you that by the end of the decade, the Congressional Budget Office is forecasting that the debt-to-GDP ratio will reach 130%. But the reality is, it's going to be 110% by then. The figure is going to be higher than that. According to my calculations, it will be 130%. And the reason for that is because the interest rate that the government is the CBO is assuming that will be paid by the government on their debt is way below the market. So we look at their budget, they put in a number which is way below the current interest rate. In fact, I've worked it out here. The interest rate they get, the forecast we're going to pay in the current year is 2.5%. Next year, 3.1%. Next year, 3.2%. And by the time we get to 2034, 3.3%. Well, all those rates are way below the current rate. So that's the first point. They're budgeting too little expenditure on interest. And the second point is the budget that they've got for the next 10 years, which is showing a deficit every year without exception. So this is the problem, spending more and more every year, not getting the budget back into balance. They make no provision for the usual things which happen, pandemics, wars, recessions, natural disasters, exceptional spending. As you know, they've just allocated $100 billion to fight other people's wars a couple of days ago. So these are extra spending which aren't in the budget and not planned. So we know from history that whatever the Congressional Budget Office puts out as a forecast is almost certainly going to be exceeded in terms of spending. So the numbers are going to be a lot worse than they predict. But the sad part here is there is no plan to bring it back into balance. And if I look at the government's very long-term budget, which I've got here, the forecast is, they only go out as far as 2054, which is, 30 years from now. So plenty of people will still be alive in America by 2054. Their forecast, their plan, and this is a plan, is for the debt-to-GDP ratio to reach 166%, which is really completely unsustainable. And as I said, it's got to be a lot worse than that, because that plan assumes that everything runs smoothly. We never go into a recession, we never have a disaster, we never have a war, we never have a crisis or anything, or any unexpected spending.
We're going to talk a little bit about pandemics in a moment, because I think that's been a big event in our recent lives. But my guest today is Clive Thompson, and we're talking about debt, essentially national debt. Clive, I wanted to change the topic slightly. You already mentioned the unexpected, like a pandemic. Tell me, in terms of early 20th century national debts, what was the impact of the COVID pandemic on the debt of countries like the United States, like the European Union? Give us a sense in proportion now that that is 4 or 5 years behind us.
So if we go back a few years ago, I haven't got the precise figures in my head, but it was of the order of the debt to GDP ratio was of the order of mid-80s. Post-pandemic, we're at or over 100% debt to GDP ratio. So the reason they spent money was they had these furlough schemes, they lent money, they guaranteed loans. There was all kinds of programs. And of course, in the United States, they had a cash giveaway. So every man, woman and child got a check in the post from the government of several thousand dollars, which they could do as they liked with. And it didn't matter whether you were a multimillionaire or a child.
They got the same.
You got the same.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that because I had a particular client living in London who happened to have an American passport. And he and his kids all got these checks and they sent them to me in Switzerland saying, can you cash them in for me? That's obviously it's quite difficult to cash in dollar checks if you're a Swiss bank, but at the end of the day, he took them to a bank in America and was able to cash them in. But you know, the guy's a billionaire, so he didn't need the money, but he got it.
So the COVID pandemic had a big impact in terms of national economies. Again, friends who know more about this than I do tell me that baby boomers, that's basically people like you and me, born between 46 and 64, roughly, are going into retirement or to blame the cost of social care. Obamacare, apparently, though well-intentioned at the time, is at fault too. What do you say to that? Is it the baby boomers' fault that we're all retiring now and the cost of social care?
The statistical fact is that it is the social welfare, the Medicare and so forth, which is
Medicare, that was the word I was looking for.
The biggest component of the increase in government spending. That's where the extra government spending's come from.
And just again, for those who are not financial people but have a vague memory, this phrase you've already used, the subprime, put that in context. I know that was around 2008 because I was in charge of the British Swiss Chamber of Commerce in Geneva at that time, and I saw the impact it had on some of our members who were in the financial markets. Just explain to us, in the context of the time, the damage that was done by that subprime mess in America and how it migrated to the United Kingdom and to Europe.
So where it started, American banks wanted to lend money, and they were paying brokers to find people who wanted to borrow that money. So if you lived in the United States, there were advertisements everywhere saying, borrow money, and there were all kinds of offers.
So retail marketing, basically.
So the brokers across the board started to cut corners in their effort to lend money. So when a family wanted to borrow money, to make sure they qualified, it was necessary, in many cases, to lie on the application form. And the broker would help them do that. So across the board, people who weren't employed were claiming to be employed. People who claimed to have a certain level of income were overstating that income. And money was lent by the banks. And every bank was trying to outdo the other in terms of expansion. Because if you didn't lend the money, Wall Street would have condemned you for not expanding. So the banks were going crazy, lending money left, right, and center. But it didn't really matter that their balance sheet was expanding would have been expanding, because they could then package these loans up, have them guaranteed by a AAA organization, which was, I think it was AIA, but the AAA insurance company would guarantee them as good as the government. And then these packages of bonds could be sold on to all and sundry. And where did they end up? They ended up in your pension fund, my pension fund. They ended up in banks. They ended up all over the place, all around the world, until people started to realize that it wasn't AAA at all. And these loans, which were supposedly worth 100%, weren't actually worth 100%. They were worth 60 or 70%, because many of the borrowers weren't creditworthy. And that's where it all started to go very wrong. It was very sad for the homeowners who'd been enticed terrible. Into borrowing
people,
things they couldn't.
People
they
lost their homes.
Yeah, they couldn't afford it.
Exactly.
They borrowed what they couldn't afford, but brokers had tricked them. Because, of course, the broker was on commission and they were tricking them into doing this.
Of course.
The net result was the banks, as a result of this, all around the world, now owned assets which were worth half what they were worth before.
As bad as that.
I don't know the precise percentage, but it was enough to wipe out. The point was, it wiped out the bank's capital and reserves.
Yeah.
That makes you insolvent. And if you're insolvent, you can't continue unless someone puts in the money. And since the share prices of these banks were approaching zero rapidly, the only one willing to put in the money were the governments.
Yes.
And that's where the governments borrowed a ton of money with a AAA reputation of the government, and gave that money to the banks as an equity investment.
And that was the meltdown, or to avoid the meltdown.
To avoid the banks going in.
I just want to change geography for a while. Two different countries. One is China, and we need to talk about the country in which we live. But very quick, I mean, if it is possible to give a fairly short answer, from what I've read, China is the second biggest, it's a fact, the second biggest economy, but I've read also it has very high levels of debt. Are the Chinese worried about that debt too? And if they're not worried, why not? And if they are worried, what are they doing about it? Just explain that to me, please.
China doesn't publish its debt figures. It's one of the few countries where the figures are just not available. So what we read about China's level of debt is just speculation.
I see.
We don't know.
I didn't know that.
But it's a reasonable assumption that they are borrowing money from someone, the banks or the public at large. But the absolute levels, nobody can find out. It's a very centrally run economy. So I don't think we can put it into the same category as the West. And I doubt very much that they borrowed as much as America or the Western banks. I mean, this is a very new economy and newly developed economy. And most of the newly developed economies don't have high levels of debt.
I see.
Because historically, they couldn't borrow as much. So I don't think it would be in a serious situation, but we don't know that.
Okay. And turning to Switzerland, we live here. I know, because I lived here at the time, that this country got into a difficult situation back in the late 80s, early 90s. high interest rates for Switzerland at that time. Even one or two cantonal banks went bust, which was unheard of. What is the situation here, and how did the country get out of trouble? What's going on here with debt in Switzerland?
Well, Switzerland is one of the safest countries in the world when it comes to debt. The level of Swiss debt to GDP, and that's according to the Swiss Federal Finance Office, is 17.8%, or 27.6% if you include the debt of the cantons, the communes, and the government. So 27.6% is the lowest in the Western world.
And there's a reason for that, isn't there? Because of the legislation that was brought in.
So there's a piece of legislation which requires the government to... So the government's debt at the moment is about 120 billion. And under the rules, they've got to reduce that by 20 billion over the next 10, 15 years, something like that. It was, if we go back a few years ago, 130 billion, but they brought that number down quite substantially because of the legislation which was brought in then. And so the government is balancing its budget and having a surplus. Part of the surplus comes from the Swiss National Bank, which pays part of its profit to the government. So unlike most Western countries, Switzerland's on a very good footing, and that explains the strength of the Swiss franc up until very recently when they reduced the rates. But it explains the strength of the Swiss franc over the long run against all other currencies. So if you look at the exchange rate of the Swiss franc to almost any country currency on the planet, you'll find the Swiss franc has been incredibly strong.
And that's also a reserve currency, so if people want to go somewhere else apart from the dollar, they go into Swiss francs, because they know it's a safe currency to be in.
They could do. The trouble would be getting any reasonable amount of Swiss francs. Don't forget, the Swiss government's debt is only 120 billion. And to put that in perspective, the US debt is 30 trillion. And China has got nearly a trillion of that. They couldn't, if they wanted to put just 10% of that into Swiss debt, that would be, let's call it 100 billion. There's the 120 billion of it out there, so it couldn't really be done. So I don't think Swiss currency is used very much as an international reserve. There just isn't enough of it out there.
I see, because of although it's a rich country, it's still a relatively small economy by global standards.
It's a big economy, but it's just got a doesn't have much debt.
I see.
Compared with other currencies. I mean, one of the interesting things is Switzerland has got more gold than per person per capita than any other country in the world. I think we're the third largest gold holder in tons of gold after the United States and Germany.
And looking completely away from a thing like gold, which has been with man since man first started to mine it, is there a role for cyber currency in these future debt scenarios, or is that a subject for a second interview, Clive?
I think the cyber or central bank digital currency will be possibly one of the ways they solve the debt crisis in the United States and other Western countries. Now, a lot of people will not like what I'm going to say, but I think that we might get to a situation where you literally have no choice but to use the central bank digital currency. That's a new currency which many governments would like to introduce to replace the existing currency, and it will be one-to-one with the existing currency. So $1 is one central bank digital currency dollar, same thing. And that's all well and good, but to all intents and purposes, you'll now have two currencies out there, the old dollar and the new dollar, of which you can only spend the new CBDC. And it won't be like that initially. It'll be a sort of dual system where you can spend the old or the new. But over time, I'm quite sure that for money laundering reasons, for taxing reasons, the governments are going to decide that all transactions must pass through the CBDC wallet so they can monitor everything we do. And that's what people aren't going to like. And then there'll come a point where perhaps in a national crisis, they put some sort of restriction on how much of your old money the money in your bank, can be converted to the spendable money, the CBDC, bottleneck it in some way. Maybe you need permission. Maybe it's limited by amount. Maybe it's limited according to the purpose for which you're going to do it. And then in a moment of crisis, it's going to be all too easy to switch off the convertibility of the old to the new. So the dollar carries on, except you can't spend your old dollars. So if you have a treasury bond maturing in 5 years and it matures, you might not be able to convert it to the new CBDC. So the government effectively has not reneged on its debt. It's not defaulted. It still owes it, but it owes it in a currency which is no longer going to affect the economy. And therefore, it can spend and borrow in the new currency with a debt to GDP ratio effectively starting at zero. Now, of course, there's going to be some big losers in this, and not least of which is all the pension funds which hold the old dollars. But you can imagine there's going to be many, many people who would be very upset if they suddenly find that they can't spend their old dollars. And I don't think it's going to be a sudden thing. I think it's going to be a gradual tightening of the noose or narrowing of the bottleneck. So that could be a way that they solve the problem. Not a good way for rich people, but I think for the man in the street, nothing to worry about.
Mm-hmm. So, Clive, as they say, this story's going to run and run. I thank you. You've helped me understand a lot, although I still have a lot more questions for you. But I'm grateful for your time. Keep up the good work you do on advising and talking the kind of common sense based on lots of experience that you do. And my guest today has been Clive Thompson, retired private banker, financial advisor and wealth manager. Thank you again, Clive.
Well, thank you very much for interviewing Michael. And if anyone has any questions, I'm on LinkedIn. You can send me a question via LinkedIn. I'll be pleased to answer.
Great. Thank you.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.